wanted to air my conversation with Kathy Matea now. It's rare that I have talked to anyone that I've enjoyed more. She's funny, engaging, down to earth, enormously talented, a multiple Grammy winner with a deep, deep love of her West Virginia roots, and has managed to convey that love while at the same time becoming an environmental activist and speaking out against mountaintop removal coal mining. She comes from a coal mining family in West Virginia, so I thought the best way to get to know her is through her album Coal, which was nominated for a Grammy for Best Traditional Folk Album. And we started by my asking her to tell us a bit about where she's from and her family background. This is Kathy Matea.
I'm from West Virginia. I grew up in Kanawha County, which is where the capital city is, Charleston. I grew up in a suburb of the capital city called Cross Lanes, named for the stoplight, the most prominent feature of our town. And my mom grew up one county west of there, down the river, in a little town called Bancroft, West Virginia. My dad grew up one county east of Kanawha County, up the Kanawha River, and his hometown was called Smithers. And both of my grandfathers were coal miners. These were the little coal towns. Also, interestingly, both of my grandfathers owned their own homes, which was unusual at that time. And they were really, really proud of it. The mine that my grandfather worked in is still going, that my dad's dad worked in. The mine that my mom's dad worked in shut down. And when the mines started to close, all the chemical plants came in, Monsanto and Carbide and Dow and Fight Chemical and FMC, and they lined the river with chemical plants because they had a hardworking workforce who didn't complain too much, who had just lost the big industry. So my dad started working at Monsanto. So I heard these stories about growing up in coal towns and what their life was like. I heard them in little bits and pieces. And when I decided to do this album, they got strung together in a larger narrative. And I came to understand my own story better. A lot of family stories came back up and got put in context. And it became more of a deeper narrative for me. I used to think, oh, you know, coal is my parents' story. It's not my story. And I came to understand that even though I was the granddaughter of coal miners, it still influenced my life heavily.
That sense of distance from mining that you initially had, I know you've given talks about renewable energy sources, moving away from coal. Was that easier in the beginning because it didn't feel like it was your people you were talking about or talking to?
No, actually, it's kind of interesting how it happened. There was a mine disaster before the Upper Big Branch disaster. There was the Sago mine disaster a couple years before, in 2006, I think it was. It was January, and I just remember all these miners were trapped for days. 13 miners were trapped, and for a while they thought they were all alive. When they found them, all but one had died. It was just this horrible roller coaster of lack of information and waiting. And I was transported back to when I was 10 years old, and there was a huge mine disaster called the Mannington Mine Disaster outside of Fairmont in West Virginia. The mine caught on fire. They wound up sealing it up with a lot of the miners still in there. They had all died, but they couldn't get to them. And what I remember, this was back when there were only three channels on your television, was the lead story on the news every night. And I knew it must be important. But what I really remember was the pall that came over my household. Both of my parents were distracted, irritable. They were being transported back to something from their childhoods. The visceral feeling of that came back to me, and I found myself riveted to the news. I'd be driving down the interstate at 3 in the afternoon and burst into tears for people I had never met in a place I'd never been. They did a public funeral for the 12 miners who had died, and the Larry King Show was going to cover it on CNN, and they asked if I would be willing to sing a song because it was live and they were going to have to leave their satellite feed at the top of the hour and they needed a way to segue out. So I called a bunch of musicians and they were all happy to come down and record something, and we did a song and we had long conversations. I was telling them that I'd just been riveted to the story, and so had all of them. And this lovely musician who was playing with us said, you know, Kathy, that's what music's for, isn't it? He said, helping us process emotions we don't always even understand. And that's when it came to me, oh, I think I need to make a record about Coleman. I think maybe that's what I need to do. In the meantime, about the same time, maybe a week later, I got an invitation to go see Al Gore speak at Vanderbilt University. I didn't know what he'd been doing. It was before the movie came out, and it turned out to be the slideshow. And I found out that they were going to train volunteers to give the slideshow as a service project. And I signed up for the first training class, which was later that year. And when I started to delve into the material, if you were going to talk about global warming and climate change, you were going to talk about coal. And all of a sudden, this record was showing up. This mine disaster had happened. I'd had these emotional responses to Al Gore's slideshow and to this disaster that had happened. And all of a sudden, everything in my life became about coal. And I was like, well, I guess we're going to be talking about coal for a while. And that was kind of how it happened.
No one works harder than miners under more dangerous conditions for the rest of us, and yet it seems we're by and large oblivious. Do you get a sense going back at all that people feel forgotten and a bit resentful?
I think it's kind of the nature of life in Appalachia, really. It's an isolated place, mostly because, you know, when I was a kid before the interstate went through, if you wanted to go from my hometown to Beckley or Lewisburg, it was 3.5 hours to go 90 miles. And you never got above third gear because you were going on windy roads through mountains and you had to be awake and alert all the time. That is also what makes the place special because communities get tightly knit. You can't just buzz into town. Town is 2 hours away if you're lucky. So communities help each other out. The other thing that I think it's hard to convey sometimes to people about Appalachia that's really special is people are really attached to a sense of place there. And it's part of what makes it really special. It's also what makes it unseen. There's not a lot of money there. It's not a fancy place. It's a very earthy place. And I think it's hard for people to really understand what life is like there. Hazel Dickens' song, West Virginia, My Home, in the dead of the night, in the still and the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight. Back to those hills, the place that I call home. And if you're from there, like, interestingly, I moved away when I was 19 to Nashville, and I've lived here ever since. But I feel like an expatriated West Virginian. I feel like a West Virginian who happens to live in Nashville.
When you were young, did you always want to get out?
No. When I was young, I always thought I would wind up there. It's the funniest thing to me that I wound up here. And it's been the right path. I feel pretty clear about that. But all my family was there. My mom, my dad, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, my friends, all the place that I knew. So I was just going to always come back to Charleston, come back to my home. Well, then I went to Morgantown and I thought, ooh, Morgantown's really pretty. It's up in the mountains. I went to WVU. Hey, I'll wind up here. That's it. I'll expand my horizons and I'll move to Morgantown. And it's a college town. It's close to Pittsburgh. That's a big city and I'll have some culture. And then in order to do what in order to find out if I had what it took to be able to do music, I felt at a certain point that I needed to go to Nashville. It was going to be the place where I could test myself, and I didn't want to. And then I put down roots here, and it's where I've built my life, but I go back a lot. My car can drive to West Virginia on its own, pretty much. One of the very cool things that happened to me as a result of making this record was Homer Hickam wrote the liner notes, and Homer wrote a book called Rocket Boys about his life growing up in a little coal town. And we became buddies after that. And he took me down in a working mine. I got to mine with a longwall miner, one of those big machines, and have lunch with all the miners and see what it was like. And I thought, oh, I can see how this would get in your blood. The world disappears and there's nothing but you and your coworkers. And you all have to watch out for each other and depend on each other. And you're working for a higher purpose. What you're doing is going to be used by the world to further the Industrial Revolution and keep lights on for people. And I can just see where it would be its own culture. It would develop its own subculture. I understood as soon as I went down there, I was like, oh, now I get it. My grandfather worked 6 days a week mining low coal. He had a pick and shovel in a 30-inch seam of coal. And my grandmother would sew leather patches onto the top of the back of his shirt so he could wedge himself into the ceiling and pick sideways into the coal. He did this 6 days a week, and in the winter he never saw the light of day, and this was a better life than the one he left in Italy. It was hard. It was the life of a laborer, but they were also really glad to have the work and not afraid of it. I think about the little old man who spoke Italian with a could barely speak English that I got to know. And then I think about what he went through in his life, you know, that we never talked about. We just took for granted. It's really something.
You've talked with so much love about all this. Did you ever worry when you spoke up about climate and energy that people wouldn't hear it that way and they'd feel like you're trying to take away their livelihoods?
No, but I'll tell you, I didn't think about that. But there is an organization in West Virginia called the Friends of Coal. And it's basically to promote coal and coal mining and the coal industry. And I started hearing about this guy who was the head of the organization who was out talking. And, you know, I'm kind of a favorite daughter of West Virginia. And he was out doing speeches. And he was like, Kathy Mattea has lost her way. So I called him up one day. And I said, hey, this is Kathy Mattea. I'm not your enemy. Tell me what you want me to know. So he took me on a tour of mountaintop removals. In the meantime, I'm hearing from people who live near these sites whose water runs black out of their taps. And so I thought, okay, if I try to listen to everyone, maybe that is a way I can be of service. I was like, I'm not going to stop talking about this. I mean, you can't send me out in the hills and the mountains and camping and hiking and all over the state when I'm a kid and then want me to shut my mouth when you start to rip the place apart. But the one thing I'm not going to do is villainize anybody. So I started to be curious about whether there was a way I could help facilitate dialogue. And what I discovered was I was asked to sing at a rally, and I found an old song by Jean Ritchie, who was from Eastern Kentucky. She wrote a song called Black Waters about her hometown in the early 70s. It was all about strip mining and what it was doing. And I realized that if I just say, before I sing it, this is the song Gene Ritchie wrote in 1972. And then I sing the song, and the song rings true for what's going on today, I don't have to say anything else. The song will do the work. And it'll do the work in 3.5 minutes that it would take an hour to beat somebody over the head with. I began to see how music could facilitate conversations that were hard to have in real life. And so then I began to develop my own slideshow that was about music and social change and how music can help people talk about subjects that are really hard. I traveled around a lot of different colleges given that, just talking to young people about where all these things come together and how to have a conversation that's not strident. I went to make this record, and I didn't realize it, but I made a record that was the greatest hits of coal. You know, like a lot of these songs were around during the folk revival, written by some of those writers before my generation. I had somebody pull me aside when I was going to do Black Lung, which is a signature song for Hazel Dickens. He said, you know, I'm a musicologist and I have a band, but we don't really do much Hazel stuff. She's really hard to cover and do well. And he was trying to tell me not to do it. And I was just too freaking stuck. I was like, yeah, but I really like it. And it took me months and months and months to get into this song. It's an a cappella song that Hazel Dickens wrote about her brother when he was dying of black lung. She has this ancient mountain voice, like she can part your hair and raise every goosebump on your body. I don't have that kind of voice. And so I figured out pretty early on that if I was going to do this song, I had to find my own way into it. So I worked for months and months and months and months on it. And I found my way into the song. I thought it sounded authentic enough that it was my version, not me trying to be Hazel. And I thought, well, I'm never going to sing it like Hazel, but there might be a generation of people who will never, ever know about Hazel Dickens. But if they hear me sing this song, they might go back and find her and rediscover her music. Sometimes I think about being from a place that has its own culture, a very clear culture, its own feel. It has its own music. Has its own sound. It has its own dialect. I feel lucky that I come from a place that stamped me so clearly.
He's had more hard luck than most men could stand. The mines was his first love, but never his friend. He's lived a hard life, and hard he'll die. Black lungs done got him, his time is nigh. Black lung, oh, you're just biding your time. Soon all of this suffering I'll leave behind. But I can't help but wonder what God had in mind to send such a devil to claim this soul of mine. He went to the boss man, but he closed the door. Well, it seems you're not wanted when you're sick and you're poor. You ain't even covered in their medical plans, and your life depends on the favors of man. Down in the poorhouse on starvation's plan, where pride is a stranger and doomed is a man. His soul full of coal dust till his body's decayed, and everyone but black lungs done turned him away. Black lung, oh, your hands I see cold. As you reach for my life and you torture my soul, cold as that water hole down in that dark cave where I spent my life's blood digging my own grave. Down at the graveyard, the boss man came with his little bunch of flowers. Dear God, what a shame. Take back those flowers. Don't you sing no sad songs. The die has been cast now. A good man is gone. He's had more hard luck than most men could stand. The mines was his first love, but never his friend. He's lived a hard life, and hard he'll die. Black lungs done got him, his time is nigh. Black lung, oh, you're just biding your time. Soon all of his suffering I'll leave behind. But I can't help but wonder what God had in mind to send such a devil to claim this soul of mine.
Kathy Mattea, Hazel Dickens, Black Lung.